everybody. How many of you were not present last week? So, what are you? All right, well, then I'm going to ask the rest of you to fill them in. This is bad. So, could I have a volunteer or two to summarize what we talked about last week? Anybody? Mark, thank you.
Let's see. So, world is doomed. Actually, talked about the sources of the thing I found most interesting, the sources of the CO2 in the greenhouse gases. They come from a lot of things, like cement creates the greenhouse source of greenhouse gases. And how long it takes the gases to actually work their way out, which is going to be a long time. How fast it's gone up. But he's going to tell how they fix it. He wants to.
I would say all that was the volume of CO2 that was used. I mean, you really know that amount of pollution.
Yeah, so the short summary of everything we said last week was that global warming is happening.
Yeah.
It's caused by us, mostly our burning of fossil fuels. It's really serious. It's very urgent. And in the next two sessions, we're going to get into how we can fix it. So we all have a part to play in this. And we spent most of last session deliberately, kind of in a review mode for many of you, talking about the impact on the planet. Today, we're going to talk, based on what we learned about the impact on the planet, we're going to talk a lot more about the impact on people. And then we're going to look at some examples, one in particular, of how people are working together as a society to solve the problem. And that will give us something to think about for the next session, where we're going to get into more detail about some of the specific solutions that you, as individuals, as households, as a community here at St. Andrews, can enact to help solve the problem. So that's the short summary of what we talked about last week. And, this course I've subtitled Creation, Care, and Climate Change, Scripture, Science, and Solutions. So we're going to have a little bit of scripture to start us out in each session to set the context. Today, I want to talk about, let me see, I think I might be a slide ahead. We're going to talk about the impact on people. And, we have a responsibility as Christians to care for each other, and specifically for the poor and the vulnerable around us. So I have started out, and I'm going to ask you, there's a Bible at each table. If you all could, starting with Psalms, I'm going to do Proverbs here. If you could look up some of those passages for me, so you don't have to sit here and wait for me to do it, that would be great. But I want to just help us get immersed in thinking about the impact of people by reading a couple of these passages, and then I want you, while we're doing that, to think about two questions. What words come to mind that best describe how we should relate to the poor and the needy around us? And secondly, what words best describe how we presently are doing that? So sort of the same exercise we did last week when we were talking about how we should relate to the rest of creation. And now we're going to talk about our responsibility towards each other. So, the word of the Lord, Proverbs, chapter 19, verse 17. Whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will reward them for what they have done. That's it. Anybody have Psalms handy? Okay, let me see if I can get there. You can look ahead for me and look up some of the others. That'd be great. 2, Psalm 82, verses 3 to 4. Defend the weak and the fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. Does anyone have Isaiah?
I have Deuteronomy.
Deuteronomy? Good. Please.
This is Deuteronomy 15, 7. If there is among you anyone in need, a member of your community in any of your towns or in the land that the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your needy neighbor.
Okay, does anyone have Matthew?
I have Matthew. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
All right. Then he will say to those at his left hand, you that are a person, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and change me. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked and you did not give me clothing. Sick and fearless and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me.
Thank you. Isaiah?
Did you offer your food to the hungry, satisfy the needs of the afflicted? Then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom be like the new day.
Thank you. And I have 1 John 3, verse 17. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? So, none of this is surprising. I'm sure we all are all steeped in the responsibility we have as Christians to care for the poor. But it's hard for us living in one of the wealthiest communities in one of the wealthiest nations on the planet to really appreciate how the rest of the world lives. So, one of the things I like to do at the start, just like last time we talked about, you know, how much is a metric ton of carbon dioxide, I'd like to talk for a second about who are the poor. And I'm going to just sort of jumpstart this conversation by saying that we have the majority of the people in this world live on less than $8 a day. Does that surprise anybody? Does that seem like $8 a day? Would that strike you and I as being someone who's poor? Okay. Yeah. So that's the majority of the population. And I'm going to, because of time today, I'm going to kind of jump us forward. This categorization you may have seen before, it talks about four levels of income and the associated lifestyles that are possible with those levels of income. And the fact is that the majority of the people who are living on less than $8 a day have a lifestyle that, you know, we have a hard time appreciating. First of all, they're getting around mostly on foot. Many of them don't have shoes, some have shoes, a few have a bicycle. They go for their water either to a natural source, just open lake, river, whatever, untreated, or they have a community well that they share. For the preparation of food, some of them are burning wood in an open fire to prepare food. Most are using some sort of gas stove. They either sleep on a dirt floor or they may share a thin mattress amongst multiple people. And finally, when you think about education, many are not going to school at all. And those who do may go just up through grade school. So that's the majority of the world's population. And the fact is that the impacts of the planet that we talked about last, on the planet of global warming that we talked about in depth last week, have a disproportionate impact on the poor, and this is going to get even more prominent in the future. So I want us to keep in mind this picture of the typical person. When we think for a moment now about how the impacts, the changes that are happening on our planet are going to affect these people. Just for reference, I did the numbers the other day. Median income in Bellevue per capita per day, about $187. So, you know, we are way off the end of this scale somewhere. And that is a privilege and a responsibility. So, what I'd like to do next is just go a step further from where we were last week. So last week we talked about all the changes that are happening to the planet as a result of global warming. And what I'd like to do today is think through as a group what some people talk about as the second and third order effects of these changes. So for this purpose, for example, we'll think about the impact of each of these changes on people, starting, for example, less snow and ice. So less snow and ice leads to, in the mountains, in the winters, leads to less water available in the rest of the year in our reservoirs for all sorts of purposes. So that can result in shortages that may force farmers to have to not produce or change their production in ways that produce less, resulting in, this is where it gets really complicated, right? Every consequence has another consequence, resulting in either shortages and or increases in prices of food. So, and then take that and think back to the impact that's going to have on the people who are trying to get by on $8 a day. So I want to do this just kind of a free-for-all here. I'm going to use the board to capture a few of these causal chains. So if you have one that you are thinking about, we talked about, so these are the second and third order changes. And we talked about snow, water shortages, crops, food prices. Someone else have a chain they want to share?
So the wildfires, I think, would lead to people losing their homes, as well as health issues from increasing pollution.
And it, you know, you can continue with this game, right? Because after a fire, an intense fire, you get things like landslides, erosion, which has impact on our water supplies. Someone else want to share a causal chain?
It's like a petty value one, but the rising sea is going to take out my bulkhead or take out my bank.
I'm sorry, that. Sea level rise. I didn't quite hear the rest. What?
It's going to take out the bulkhead, which will take out the bank.
Yep. So your bulkhead's going to say, well, this, you, I mean, you do that jokingly, but you know what they're talking about doing in New York City right now? There's a $10 billion proposal to try and create a bulkhead around the southern end of Manhattan to prepare for the next superstorm. As you know, what happened in Superstorm Sandy, the damage was severe to the subways, the electrical substations, everything was greatly affected. They're trying to figure out now how to prepare us for that inevitability of greater storms. So, right here.
Well, it's along the same lines, but rising sea levels really impact coastal communities. Yeah. They have huge and then forced migration, which then
so the loss of land.
Yeah, loss of land forces migration and refugee crises.
Yep.
And we can go on from there.
I was in Alaska recently, and there are communities that are moving, and they really don't want to, but they're being forced to. And in that case, it's a little different chain. It's coming from the loss of ice, which was kind of a bulkhead for them in the winters against storms. So it's sort of a similar sort of chain, has a different set of consequences. I think there was someone else right here.
I was going to say with the fires too, with that whole storm, then there's loss of employment, there's loss of business. I mean, so that all is another area where people.
Yeah, there's another causal chain.
Homelessness, too, like in paradise.
Jobs, income are all going to be lost. Anybody else want to back on the left?
The current permafrost is leading to the rise of superbugs. and methane.
So, yeah, these have a bunch of them. So there's health issues. We didn't talk about forest disease, but that's one of the things that's happening that affects us locally. Right here?
I was going to say that when you talk about climate change, you're not just talking about global warming, but more dramatic weather events. So whether they're
right,
bombs, cyclones...
So they stronger storms, we talked about that.
What happens is then you have significant property loss, whether it's 1,000 head of cattle in eastern Washington or hundreds of homes because of excessively large tornadoes. And then that then results in an economic swing with insurance. And insurance prices could very likely climb as a result. And people might not be able to afford that, and then you just have a greater disproportion of wealth again.
So I can relate to that one very closely. With a different chain, fire to insurance, because there are people around us over at Lake Wenatchee where we have a home that are not able to get insurance now.
Yeah.
Because of all the, we've had fires all around us. We're just fortunate. We haven't personally been affected by them yet, but it's been all around us.
But Mark, well, the other thing I think that property loss just doesn't affect people directly, but also tend those major events tend to force a lot of pollution into the system.
Yeah, that's one I became aware of recently when I looked at an investment in a company that was building some sensors you could put out in various places in the drainage systems to help us understand where the bottlenecks were that were causing what they call combined sewer outflows. You really don't want to know about this, but it's a problem that's sitting back there. Most of our big old cities have these systems that combine storm drainage and sewer drainage at some point. And when we get these extreme events, it backs up and it goes everywhere. And the city of Seattle is under injunction of some sort from the Environmental Protection Agency going way back because they have too many of these combined sewer outflows, they call them. So not a pretty picture. In the back, Danny?
So Sojourner Magazine just had a big article on this recently, and I found it absolutely fascinating. It's the social economics. So if we take a look at Florida, Florida's losing, right? So
yeah.
The wealthy who have their beautiful homes here are now having to move back into the neighborhood where the poor people would live before that, would commute into the city to clean houses, to be at the hotel, to do all the labor jobs that wealthy people really like. And yet they're going to displace them that much further. And what they're concerned about is the poorer people who live in these neighborhoods, they don't have the next place to buy you. They do not have a place to live. So they're displacing. When global warming happens and we lose land and the wealthy that get to live on there, they move further inland, which displaces those who, and they can take away their homes in a horrible way.
So I'm going to move us forward because this exercise can be played out ad infinitum. And it is reinforcing a point that I try to communicate, which is that climate change is a problem that makes all other problems worse. And that's not to say we don't have other problems that we need to focus on, but we need to be thinking about the impact of this problem on all those other problems. And one of the things I would emphasize is that there are a lot of national security professionals who think that climate change may actually be our biggest security issue of the present, even, not to mention the future, because they describe it as a threat multiplier. I have a brother-in-law who's a upper general in the Army, and they are studying this a lot because it's the planning that they have to do. A lot of their planning is around this. So the overall point is that the impacts on people are going to be profound. And they're starting to happen now. I mean, we've all encountered little examples of this around us. They're going to get much more severe. Some of the big themes that when you do this exercise, you tend to land on certain things multiple times. One of the big ones is mostly through water, but through other mechanisms as well, across. Another big one kind of through sea level, but it's kind of this property loss. Because, you know, most of our cities, most people live on coasts. And so they're either in an area that's likely to be affected by rising sea level directly through high sea level or indirectly through storm surges that swell the seas greatly during severe storms. So you get a lot of property loss. And this one also comes up time and again. So if you think our chapters with respect to migration are big now, they're going to get a lot more severe if we don't figure out how we can change. So it kind of gets you in a bad frame of mind when you do this exercise a bunch. That's not my goal here. My goal, because we're going to switch gears here in a moment and talk about more about what we can do about it, but I want to help us think about the impact of all of those things on most people. We're going to be relatively insulated from this. Not completely insulated, but relatively insulated because of our wealth, because of our location. But other people are extremely exposed. You had a question?
One thing I don't see on here is the effect of the creatures around us, the wildlife.
Well, it's right here. Changes in animal migration and life cycle.
Yeah.
We talked about it last week.
About that change.
Yeah.
Every one of these chains which is building affects.
Yeah. It gets really complicated. I'm going to move us forward then to focus just for a moment more specifically on what we think we should expect to see here. I'm going to do this through largely through an example of something that happened recently that is, I think, a foretaste of what's to come. But the stressors that, and this is from the National Climate Assessment, the recent document, that are the stressors that are most prevalent in this area include things related to the warmer winters and the lower snowpack coming from that, water shortages, ocean acidification. We haven't talked about that yet, but we have a significant seashell and fisheries industry that's affected by that. Sea level rise and surge. We do have some coastal communities that are moving. I can't remember which one it is. I'm going to have it Moclip somewhere. There's a community that's moving now because they can't take their storm surges anymore. Drought and deluge, the overall quantity of rain may be similar, but we're more likely to have severe droughts for a while and then extreme deluge for a period that has a lot of consequences for all sorts of things. Stream flows fluctuating being one of them, and associated with that, landslides and erosion affecting things like trains, for example, that run up and down the coast. And lastly, the thing that we may experience most, heat waves. So I want to think back to 2015. Do you remember?
One more thing to add to that.
Yeah.
All this smoke.
That's not a climate stressor. That's a result of some of these climate stressors leading to fires, leading to smoke. So these are the first order changes. Remember thinking, is that the impact on the planet? How's that going to affect us? Well, think back to 2015, the winter of 2015. Remember, we had a really unusual winter, and I have some of the basic stats on it here. We had 80% reduced snowpack overall. I mean, we had like 5 or 10% of our usual snowpack in the Olympics, and it varied around the state. We had ski areas that were, some of which only stayed open through January, and they had, you know, a very abbreviated season. There, over the summer, the following summer, 1.6 million acres in Oregon and Washington burned. We, in our budget, took a hit as a state of $600 million in firefighting costs. The agricultural industry in the state took a loss of somewhere around $700 million due to those events. There were salmon kills in a number of streams because the water was too warm and there wasn't enough oxygen and they just couldn't survive. We had an algae bloom out on the coast that closed a number of fisheries for a while. So these, if I can get anything, those are the main ones. So these are the examples of what can happen when we get really one significant climate stressor, a warmer winter, resulting in less snowpack, and all of these ripple effects. Industries that are going to be affected in this state are numerous. Some of the areas where we have forestry now that's marginal, in the northeast and the east side of the Cascades, it may not be practical in the future. There's going to be a lot more disease in forests, things like pine beetles, their habitat is shifting and it's going into places where they're going into places where trees haven't seen them before, and the trees can't respond fast enough to protect themselves. They can't evolve to protect themselves against the pine beetles. So Colorado has something like 1.3 billion trees or something like that that are affected by this stuff. The number, I may have the number wrong, but it's a huge number. It's a huge impact, in part because of the impact on the forestry industry, but also then fire. These trees are much more likely to burn, so we're likely to see a lot more fire. Water shortages, the Yakima Valley is quite stressed these days, and they're actually talking about a pipeline from, it's one of the big reservoirs that you see when you go over the pass, because they need more water than they're getting right now. They have a lot of specialty crops, which are very valuable, but they require water that they can't get just from the environment. Storm surges, seashell industry is very threatened. We talked about that a little bit. Their shells are softening in more acid water, that because the oceans have largely saved us to date from the brunt of the impact of the increased levels of carbon dioxide. But that's filtering through to the seafood industry. And we talked about skiing. Our hydropower supplies are going to be affected. If we have less water, we start having to think about rationing between people using water and farmers using water and industry using water for generating electricity. And infrastructure, someone had brought up earlier what's happening in Seattle with needing to put more money into making our city more resilient from some of these changes. We talked about the combined sewer outflows problem. There's a big investment that needs to be made to prevent more of that from happening. So we won't be sheltered from it. It will affect us greatly. So, setting aside the $8 per day majority of the rural people, we're going to be affected as well.
All right, well, now that I've got everybody really good about things,
I want to go a little deeper into who is contributing most to the problem. Because I think there's not a very good understanding of this. This group here in this room, both the people here last week and you this week, are very well informed. You're in that 10% of the population we talked about that understands, that scientists agree that this is really serious, it's human caused, it's happening, and that there's no other good explanation than the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions that come out of our use of primarily fossil fuels. But I think we don't understand how it all adds up. And so I want to ask you, we'll do this as kind of a little contest to see who can guess which of these bars, which represent the per capita emissions of carbon dioxide, go with which country. So this is per capita emissions based on how much energy is used and the kinds of energy that are produced in a country. It doesn't even think about other impacts like from importing goods. So let's start on the left. Who wants to guess which is the bar?
China.
Did someone say China?
I know.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. We're going to come back to that in a minute. But someone say United States. Were there any others?
Russia.
Okay. So, without further ado, that's us.
Yeah.
So we're at over 16 metric tons per person. Now remember, okay, who can tell me what does a metric ton look like? Thank you. Yeah, so a sphere, 10 meters in diameter, or 33 feet. So, you couldn't fit one of them in here. It's too short. I'm feeling too short. But a sphere, 33 feet in diameter, represents a metric ton of carbon dioxide at sea level at normal atmosphere pressure. This number is really underestimated for us because there's this thing we talk about as the carbon loophole. We crank
outsource a lot of our pollution to Asia, and we're buying it back in the goods. They make them over there, they take the hit on the pollution, and we buy the goods back. And there's a lot of greenhouse gases embedded in those things. It ranges from your computers to that. So the Union of Concerned Scientists has analyzed this and thinks that our per capita income impact is more like 21 when you consider all the goods we purchase. Next one.
UK.
UK?
Saudi Arabia.
Okay, you know too much. Yeah, Saudi Arabia is very high, and this is because they have so much fossil fuel energy lying around that they're having to just keep taking it out of the ground, use as much of it as they can, and frankly, it takes a lot of energy to subsist in the desert with the cities that they've created and keep all the people in there cool. In addition, we mentioned last week that a lot of methane comes out when they drill for oil, just gets burned because they don't have the equipment in all the oil rigs to capture it and use it and ship it. So they just burn it off. So Saudi Arabia is very high. Who wants to get the next one? It's not very good.
No,
it's not a big population, but so the Who's got the next one?
China.
For similar reasons, right? Russia has a lot of fossil fuel resources, and they ship a lot of natural gas to Europe. And because they have a lot of it, again, not a very big, not a very wealthy country, bigger country, about 140 some million people.
So, going back to your comment in the U.S. about outsourcing part of our pollution, well, doesn't that also take the income out of oil and get the Saudi Arabia as well? It's all part of the fact that we buy.
Yeah, and that's what this accounts for, right? This looks at our energy use. So if we bring in oil and use it, burn it to in our cars or to create electricity, that's income, actually, right? But not if it comes in the form of a computer or cement or steel or all sorts of other things that took a lot of had a lot of carbon emissions associated with that. How about, I'm going to skip to the next one that's been raised a couple of times now. So China's less than half per capita. They have a lot of people. A lot of those people don't live still in cities. Many of them do now. But they also aren't that wealthy overall compared to the United States. They don't buy and use as much stuff. But they'd like to. They very much would like to. And their emissions per capita have been increasing. If you were to adjust for this carbon loophole effect, their emissions per person might be below 6. And ours are more like 21. So that's true. And China is trying to put clean energy to use as fast as possible. They've got more solar than anybody in the world. They've taken over the solar industry. They're putting up more wind, I think, than anybody in the world. They're putting up more hydro than anybody in the world. But they're still burning a lot of coal. And they're slowing down, but they're not stopping. In fact, some of their companies are now helping other countries build coal plants because they know how to do it and they want to make money. So, and in the course of doing what we've been doing for a long time, they are likely to increase their per capita emissions. Next one. Who can guess what the next bar is? Someone said India?
India.
Okay. This is not, I think of it as a country, but it's the European Union overall. Right? And this is one of the few places where the emissions have actually been dropping. And I think they're attributable to two things primarily. One is that they have been investing a lot in their building infrastructure and trying to reduce the amount of energy associated with heating and cooling buildings. They've also been changing the rules for their utilities, like the UK changed the rules for how the utilities function in a way that made the utilities just say, okay, we don't want to do coal anymore. So they've been shifting rapidly out of coal. And then thirdly, you know, places like Germany have some of the most developed in the Nordic countries. Germany has some of the most developed solar industry, and the Nordic countries have some of the most developed wind production facilities. So they're switching rapidly as rapidly as they can to clean energy sources. And there are some places in Europe now where wind, for example, is the majority of the energy for the country. In the Netherlands, maybe. The next one. You guys ought to like this one. There are probably some Scandinavians here, right? Just a guess. Sweden. So the Swedes actually lead the EU in the in reducing their carbon footprint as a society. And we're going to look into that in detail in a moment. I'm going to skip ahead quickly in the interest of time. The next to India. Yes, they burn a lot of coal to produce electricity, but there are 300 million people in, 300 million people in India who don't even have access to electricity. So there's an opportunity here to just skip fossil fuels entirely for those 300 million people. That's the United States, right? In population. Skip that, go directly to solar. So just like, you know, a lot of Latin America, South America, skipped landlines, went directly to self-powers. So there are technological fixes that they could adopt, and they very much are exposed and realized it because of some of the populations on the coast. And then lastly, there's the rest of the world. So again, because of this income effect, now, these are wealthy countries by and large, with the exception of India. China is becoming wealthy, and associated with that are higher levels of carbon emissions per capita.
I think what typically throws up this discussion usually is that it's usually discussed in terms of per capita, in terms of total amount of pollution. So people, when you're talking about this, well, look at China, they're contributing more than we do, totally, maybe. And so this puts it in a new light when you talk about per capita.
With the emphasis on maybe, because if you do proper accounting, and you look at all the stuff we buy from China, that's really on us. So, and that's part of the challenge of this economy we live in. We ship stuff all over the world that has a bunch of greenhouse gas emissions associated with it. We need to move our economy to where we produce more locally, produce more close to us. And we can do it. We're going to talk about how that can happen.
It'd be interesting to put up there the cost per kilowatt hour against that term. What you pay in that location per kilowatt hour per energy use.
Well, first of all, it'd be really hard to do, right? Because in the United States, Hawaii is like 21 cents a kilowatt hour. New York might be 17. Here we pay 11. And Lake Wenatchee, I pay 2.5.
But if you average it, I bet you'll see that EU and Sweden are three times the average of the U.S.
It's quite possible that their overall cost of energy are higher. That's largely because of policy, which we're going to talk about in a moment. So, again, I'm not sure I can help you feel better, except that you should feel better because we're going to talk about now about Sweden and what they've done. And if we all live like the people in Sweden are living when it comes to our carbon emissions, about a third of the global carbon emissions would just go away. There's still a lot of work to do on the other two-thirds, but that's a really dramatic change. So hold that thought. We'll come back to that in a moment after we talk about the example of Sweden. So I want to spend a few minutes now just having you at your table. We've had a pretty good discussion so far, so I think some of this has come out, but I'd like to have you all spend a few minutes just talking amongst yourselves about what, you know, new insights or understandings have come out from what we just talked about, what concerns you have as a result of what you've learned, and I want to know if it changes how you feel about this problem in any way. So why don't you just go ahead and talk amongst yourselves for a moment, and then we'll come back. Remember, you're going to be asked to tell what your neighbors think. So I would like to ask a couple of volunteers to share not what you think or what new insights you have or new concerns, but what your neighbor said. So thinking about what your neighbor said, I'd like to have you tell me what your neighbor said is new or a new concern. Do you want to start?
My neighbor said that
It doesn't do much good if individually we stop buying water in plastic bottles. It has to be mandated. It has to be a law. It has to be
a policy change.
It has to be a policy change. So what we do individually doesn't really help that much.
Okay, so we had one, I guess that's a concern.
Yeah,
concern that maybe what we do individually doesn't count that much. And we have to have rules that about how all of us need to behave. Okay.
We talked about the impact of travel on climate change, carbon pollution, and federal harm. Attitudes versus maybe attitudes just maybe people seem to have or European mm-hmm. people have. Just getting a handle on that and even the relative pollution from different modes of transportation.
So you were thinking your neighbor was concerned about their travel and the impact that that has on their carbon footprint? Does that summarize that?
Something to think about.
Okay. Somebody else? Right here?
One of the things that people brought up early on was just changing how you feel, like how generally, like, oh, it's not going to impact me in my lifetime kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But looking at like the impact that it will have on our children and our children's children and the future, that it will really impact and that we do have a responsibility now to that change.
You know, I want to thank you for bringing that up. We're going to pause and we're going to amplify that for a second. So we talked at the outset about our responsibility to the poor and the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Well, frankly, the unborn are extremely vulnerable right now. They have, they're not part of the problem. They're going to be living with the consequence of it. And, you know, we have a rather short window in comparison to think about this. And, you know, I think that we're going to really take our responsibility for the needy seriously. We need to also define needy in terms of future populations. So thank you for that. Anybody back here? Okay, well, I want to move us forward. We've got kind of a late start this morning. And I want to look more specifically now and more hopefully about what we can accomplish if we work together and decide that we want to change. So Sweden, and I'm going to do this in the form of a case study, and I apologize, some of this is going to be a little policy wonkish. There's going to be some details about what Sweden's doing that might be kind of hard to remember, but we'll get the overall picture from it. So Sweden started in the late 90s to really take a serious look at this problem and decided as a society that they wanted to do something about it. It really came around even before the Kyoto Accords in 1998, but because in part of their experience through the oil crisis, etc. They just have a strong ethos around the environment. So they started setting goals, and then they followed it up with policies that are strong and have had a lot of impact. And I want to just do a compare and contrast for a moment. So the first goal they set is we got to get on the clean energy as fast as we can to reduce the amount of our energy as for our whole economy that's coming from oil and gas. And so they set this goal of getting 50% clean energy, all uses, by 2020. And they made it in 2016. So there, we'll see in a moment where they are. They are now on a goal of trying to get to 63% greenhouse gas reductions by 2030. So that's 11 years from now. Relative to 1990. So that's kind of the benchmark that I think is, should be in all of these statistics. And then they have a goal of getting to zero impact net. They recognize there's still going to be some sources in the economy of greenhouse gas emissions, but they're going to do things to offset that. So they set strong goals. We in the United States have no federal goals when it comes to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. None. And when I say federal goals, I'm talking about things that have been passed by Congress and made the law of the land. We had a brief period where we attempted to bring in a cap and trade scheme to reduce emissions by putting a price on emissions. Didn't pass. It was in about 2009. And then the Obama administration tried to start the Clean Power Plan. That never even got out of the courts. It's a change behavior because a lot of utilities realize you've got to change. So, you know, if Bahman doesn't do it, someone else will. So they started thinking about changing more. But we have no policies that, and no plan, and no goals even. That we'll talk about the plan in a minute. In fact, our goals are to, right now, and the current administration, get out of whatever obligation we committed to as part of the Paris Accords. Now, that's not to say that things aren't happening. They're just happening at the state level. So there are about 20 states that have targets. Some of them are making great progress, and some of them are very influential ones, like California, New York, and Massachusetts.
These tell us we are one of those.
What's that?
These tell us we are one of those.
Washington is making progress as well. We didn't have as hard a job to do. We started with 75% hydropower for our electrical grid, thanks to the federal government. It wasn't something we did. We inherited this, you know, hydropower infrastructure, and the region has a lot of that benefit. So that's good. We're making moves in the right direction. The whole West Coast is really. We are, Oregon is, BC is, California is. So that's good news. There's targets, there's plans that are coming out. And this current legislative session has a whole bunch of good stuff happening in it that will move us in the right direction. But I'm looking just right now at Sweden versus federal U.S. When it comes to policy, I'm going to get it, you can have goals, but if you don't actually start doing something to make the goals happen, it's all this talk. And they started putting together an integrated climate and energy plan. In fact, I'm pretty sure the agency is the administrator for energy and the environment. And they took a very comprehensive look at what needed to happen and started to make changes in all areas. They put in place a broad carbon tax in 1995. Probably the most important thing they did. It wasn't just on a small number of big emitters. It was on everybody. And the households. And households were aware of the fact that they were paying fees associated with the amount of pollution they emitted from their use of various forms of fossil fuel energy. They did a whole bunch to also, in addition to sort of the stick of the taxes, they also had a whole bunch of tariffs that they put in place for people to start changing, insulating, you know, switching to clean electricity if they were using natural gas or oil to heat their homes. They provided a lot more information so people could make decisions. So when you buy a building in Sweden, it's very likely that you can look at a report that will tell you exactly what the energy consumption is for that building. They also gave a lot more choice to people. There are like 140 different suppliers of energy to households that you can pick from. I don't have any choice. I got to take what Puget Sound Energy gives me, and it happens to be mostly coal and natural gas right now. It's changing, but that's what it is right now. So the contrast here is pretty stark. Again, we don't have a federal plan. We have a few incentives for certain things that have kind of snuck in, like solar, for some new industries. We do have cap and trade frameworks in place, largely through the 13-state regional greenhouse gas initiative up in the Northeast, focused on just the largest polluters in the power sector. And California has one as well, and they're starting to connect some of these things so we can make them more impactful. But the cap and trade policies have had flaws, frankly. They haven't set the cap high enough. They haven't reduced it steadily enough. It's a complicated thing to try and get right. We still subsidize oil and gas to a very significant level at the federal level, and much more so than we do subsidize, for example, solar power or electric vehicles. And it's really hard to go, if you want to buy a house or rent an apartment, really hard to get any sort of useful information about what the energy consumption of that building is and how it compares to others. This was something I did a lot of work on 2 years ago. I made a grant to help the first implementation of a policy to score residences for buyers in Portland, the city of Portland, the home energy score policy. So now if you go to buy a house in Portland, you get a little report It has a score like an MPG per gallon rating for your car, same thing for the house. Scale of 1 to 10, tells you where you sit relative to this house sits relative to other homes. More importantly, it also tells you what you can do to reduce the energy consumption and how much those changes might change the utility bills. So it's based on models, so it's not perfect, but it's also based on some really good data they collect through a home energy score assessment, which is a lot like when you get a house inspection, right? Very detailed look at the state of the house. So this is new. We are hopeful that it will have a lot of impact. It will start to get people thinking about not just granite countertops, but boring stuff like insulation and ceiling of ducts and all that kind of stuff. So power monopolies we just talked about. So again, the contrast is pretty stark at the federal level. And it's not surprising then when you look at the energy and emissions impacts for these two countries. First of all, let's talk about efficiency. This is 2016 information. Efficiency simply, unit of output, gross domestic product, energy inputs, in order to have a one term to describe all energy is kilogram of oil equivalent. So in Sweden, they produce $6.67 of output for every $1,000 of output for every kilogram of oil energy input. Ours is about half that. So they're about twice as efficient in their economy. As I mentioned, they hit their goal of majority clean energy in 2016, or at 54%. The United States is still at 11%. Clean electricity, the grid in Sweden is almost entirely clean at this point. There are no fossil fuels, very little fossil fuels being used to generate electricity. In the United States, it's still, the majority of it, two-thirds of it is coal and natural gas. They've done a lot with biofuels, and this is partly because they're very good with wood. And most of the biofuels are most of the additions to fuel that they're putting are derived from wood products. Another about 90%, about 10% is from waste, vegetable oil, and other stuff. They've incorporated a lot of that into the fuels that are used in the fuel transportation in the country. Ours is about at 5%. Good question.
So are you saying natural gas? Is that why you said we've got biofuels?
No, by biofuels, I mean things that come from plants.
Yeah.
Also.
So that's all they're using? Just biofuels?
So think of a gallon of gas.
Yeah.
We put about 5% ethanol in it, mostly coming from corn. They put about 20% additives in, mostly coming from wood. Okay, so that's how they have reduced their use of gasoline by about 20% by mixing in 20% ethanol.
They don't have solar or wind or hydro, right?
Different thing. That's transportation fuel. That's the liquid fuel that goes in the tank. They absolutely have a lot of hydropower and nuclear. They have solar and they have wind. So they brought all of those things into the, okay, we've got to wrap up here in a second. So the result of all that is that their emissions have dropped pretty dramatically relative to 1990. And that's part of what reflects their low per capita greenhouse gases. I'm just going to summarize this for you. They are frankly better off as a result of doing all these things. The economy's grown better. They're more productive per person. They have better health statistics than we do. And they score better on happiness indices. So I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say I don't think the Swedes are suffering as a result of these changes. They're not taking cold showers in the dark. They're living pretty good lives, and they're quite satisfied with these changes. So I had hoped to get you to tell me, why aren't we doing all this stuff? But because we have to wrap up, I'm going to say that we could do this too. There is a surprising amount, I don't think anybody really appreciates this, there's a surprising amount of agreement amongst both parties, as divided as they are on so many things, about things that we need to do, registered voters' opinions, Yale Climate Communications Project, voters agree we should have tax rebates on efficient cars and solar panels. We should use more solar energy. We should regulate CO2 as pollutant. We should participate in the Paris Climate Agreement. We should have a revenue neutral tax on fossil fuels. And we should reduce our emissions regardless of what other countries do. It's just bunk to say we should not do it because China's not doing enough of it. I hope you've got that out of your head now, because they have much lower contributors per person in the problem than we are. So all of these things are agreed to by a majority of registered voters, for both the Democrats and the Republicans. So I don't think we need to wait. I think we could go get these things done. And I had hoped to have a few minutes to have you think about how we're going to make that happen. But we're running out of time, so we're going to have to feel free to talk about it. You don't have to go to the 11 o'clock service, but we're going to address this in the next section when we talk about what we're going to do to stabilize the climate. And I'm going to share with you the solutions that we have that we can implement right now to help solve the problem. Questions?
Well, another question. Just wanted to figure clearly we're very well informed.
Yeah.
And you do a good job in presenting your information. We thank you for that.
You're welcome. And the but now it comes to the homework. So if you haven't signed a sheet to give me your email address, please do so. I have a little exercise I'd love for you to do. Don't sweat it and try to spend too much time on it. But if you have things like the number of miles you drive in a year, the flights you take, your utility bills, the kilowatt hours, the therms, a guess that you're spending on goods and you're spending on services, how many meals you eat that have each week that have meat. There's a single page form that I have for you that you can put in some of that information into, and it'll just crank out a number that represents your carbon footprint as a household. So I'm gonna, if you sign up, I will send you a pointer to this and ask you to give it a try for next week's session. We're gonna talk about what we all individually can